Now, normally at this time of the year, the biggest challenge facing parents is sorting out school kit, preparing teenagers for that early morning alarm. But the pandemic, of course, has brought far greater dilemmas. How safe are classrooms? What is plan B if a school does face an outbreak? If one child gets it, does the whole school go home? There's lots of questions. See, the chief medical officer in England, Chris Whitty, has said children could be at greater harm by staying home than going back to classes. The Prime Minister, as we've just mentioned, has echoed that, stressing that nothing will have a greater effect on the life chances of our children than returning to school. Let's just have a catch up with our friends at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Dr. Tom Wingfield is a senior clinical lecturer and an honorary consultant physician there. Dr. Tom, good morning to you. Thanks for being with us.
Morning, morning, Tony. Morning, everyone. Thanks for having me.
So, with children returning to school in a little over a week's time, what are your thoughts on children being at low risk or very, very small, as Chris Whitty put that yesterday, or passing on COVID-19? It is a worry, isn't it? But the children have to go back.
Yeah, firstly, I think it's obviously a difficult time for pupils and students and teachers, especially with the recent exam issues, and I know that there's a huge amount of work and preparation going on in schools. I think it's about balancing that health and social impact and the short and long-term impacts, because we know that education reduces inequality and it does improve life and work opportunities and actually has a positive effect on health. And we also know that, unfortunately, disadvantaged children have been hardest hit by lockdown. I think we can be reassured that children rarely themselves get severe COVID-19 disease. And also the evidence does suggest that primary school age children at least do have lower rates of infection. But secondary school students, it's less clear cut.
But the worry is, particularly for teachers, is how do we know if they're asymptomatic? We don't know whether they're passing it on or not.
So there is an element of difficulty in terms of the fact that in some places there is asymptomatic transmission, as you mentioned. I think that the main thing is that the rates inside schools are actually probably going to be driven by infections in the wider community and actually infections from home. So I think actually just thinking about what we're all doing in the community in terms of trying to reduce COVID risk is probably the most important thing here. And obviously schools are trying to do what they can in terms of supporting each other in terms of hand washing and social distancing. But I think they do still need that support from government to help with those measures.
Any teacher will tell you that once school starts, I mean, let's just pretend that COVID never happened, but once the schools start to go back, any teacher will tell you they end up with colds and coughs and sneezes and anything that the kids have. Though this time, we're washing our hands more, there's hand sanitisation units, there's gels, there's social distancing, so hopefully, not just COVID, but all of the other little bugs might take the knock as well through this.
Absolutely. I think that's a positive thing that may come out of this, that we're all much more aware of what to do to try and avoid these bugs and what to do when we do have symptoms to try and make sure that we don't pass these things on. So I do think you're right that those are things that may be helpful with other coughs and cold bugs that do come around, especially as we approach autumn and winter.
Yeah. You mentioned the procedures that have been put in place, and I think you said, and rightly so, that teachers and schools have worked really hard to put these in place, and there's going to be bubbles. And staggered start times. But once the children leave school and go through the school gates, and sometimes, they'll mix together on the way home, they're going home, they're mixing with different kids, they might meet different kids coming from different schools on the way home as well. You just can't police that. There's only so much you can do.
So I think you're right that it's difficult to, account for all eventualities. And I think that we can start with schools, we can start with homes. We're obviously already doing things in the community, in hospitals and in care homes. And I think that we can all try and follow the advice to the best of our knowledge. We know about wearing masks, for example, on bus or the social distancing that's even happening on public transport. So I agree that it's impossible to account for all of these things, but I think that we're all in this together and we can all keep trying to do the things that will help to reduce transmission.
The World Health Organization, the WHO, said children over 12 should wear face masks or coverings to combat COVID, but the UK government said they're not recommended for use by primary or secondary pupils. What are your thoughts on that, Tom?
So I think that In terms of primary schools, I tend to agree. In terms of the transmission risk, I do think evidence is emerging all the time about masks, and we have good evidence for healthcare settings, but it's a bit more difficult outside of them. And originally, at the start of the pandemic, we did take the precautionary principle that actually it was unlikely to be harmful to wear masks and possibly beneficial. It seems like the UK government, like it did with PPE, is possibly gathering information on this and may make a decision on this later. But I think the main message from WHO is that mask wearing is especially pertinent in certain situations, for example, where you can't keep that 1 metre distance or you're somebody at higher risk. So I suppose in schools, let's just try and not have that situation where we can.
And it's been difficult, hasn't it? Because when this whole thing started, we were desperate for information. We were desperate for news. And of course, you know, the media would deliver the news. But there was a lot of speculation. There was a lot of ifs, buts and maybes and woulda, shoulda, coulda. And we absorb that as members of the public. And that's when we start to, you know, to put the pieces together in our mind to make up a story that might not necessarily be fact.
Yeah, I do think that the messaging and the messages that have been given out both on a national level and local level, I think that's something that we have to learn to do better. And I think that we have to try and make sure that the facts get out there. As you said, they get out there in real time and they reach people on platforms that they use, you know. So not, for example, just television or not just newspapers, but other platforms on their phones, for example. But it is clear that we need to just make that information as clear and as accurate as possible. And I agree with you, that has been an issue throughout this pandemic.
Your thoughts on local lockdowns as well? There's been new rules, Tom, on socialising to try and stop the spread of the virus in the northwest. And people in Birmingham are being warned there could be a lockdown on the way. We just don't seem to be getting the message. And earlier on in the summer, we saw, you know, crowded beaches. We saw a lot of protests. We saw a lot of football crowds as well. And we expected spikes after that. We expected clusters. And that really didn't seem to happen. I suppose it just goes to show how unpredictable that this virus can be.
So it can be unpredictable. We are seeing that the proportion of positive tests being done in certain areas of the country, for example, certain areas of Manchester, is increasing. And I do think that local lockdown measures are necessary in some of those places. And actually, when you look back, it's what we've done for centuries with other pandemics, even if you look back to the Black Plague. But it does rely on knowing your local numbers. So not just how many are testing or positive, but the proportion of tests that are positive. And just like you mentioned earlier, it relies on good communication. So, for example, the warning to residents of Blackburn and Oldham about stopping socialising, I think that communication could have perhaps been clearer. And finally, we just need to have trust and rapport within the community, which I think has actually been a success of Liverpool City Council's response to this, making it less anonymous and closer to the people who are affected.
Yeah, I think the Princess Ward just goes to show. I think the council got a handle on it pretty early doors and sorted that. And we did see the benefits of that, didn't we? You know, a matter of days later.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that was a really good response, a very positive thing.
And if we go back to the start of this in March and April and part of May, and we were looking at, you know, infection rates, and we were looking at figures and testing and there was a lot of percentages that were mentioned. I mean, we are nowhere near. We've come so far in a good way, in a positive way, to those dark early days. And when we talk about, you know, new infections, you know, we're looking for more. So it stands to reason if there are more eyes looking for something, we're going to find more. But we're nowhere near those rates we were in March and April, are we?
No, absolutely not. I think that the rates have come down a lot. I think we're waiting to see what happens, obviously, in the coming weeks. But you're right that to some extent there has been some control over the virus in terms of those decreasing rates. And I think that is a positive. I think also that hopefully we, the public, hospitals, care homes, schools, we are all much better prepared than we were back in January, February, March time. So I think there have been a lot of positives to come out of this.
And I think it's just important to say, because we're all a little bit cheesed off with it now, it doesn't mean it's gone away.
No, obviously we had the the brief from the World Health Organization over the weekend, that they said that it was that the pandemic was going to be over in 2 years. And I think it's just important to make clear that the pandemic being over really just means that there's not sustained transmission of coronavirus in multiple countries. But I think that this may be with us as a seasonal virus. But hopefully we will get that vaccine that Liverpool has been working so hard on with other people to try and help us to prevent COVID. And we might end up having to have a vaccine perhaps each year if this became seasonal.
Let's hope so. Dr. Tom, thanks for your expertise. Really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Tom Wingfield, Senior Clinical Lecturer and Honorary Consultant Physician at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Lucky, aren't we?
Yes, we're lucky. So lucky that throughout this we've had so many people to put us right when we might be a bit worried and explain it properly.
Crumbs of comfort and all that.
Yeah.
Made stars out of Bertie Squire, tell you. He's got his own show.
Yeah, as you say, selfies, autographs, everything for Bertie.
Oh, it's been good and we're heading in the right direction as well. But as you say, just because we're a little bit fed up with it doesn't mean it's gone away. 18 minutes